but I'm not very good at giving people orderly explanations of things. I took the money from the envelope and put it in my wallet. The envelope itself I crumpled and threw in the wastebasket. So this was how secrets started, I thought to myself. People constructed them little by little. I had not consciously intended to keep Mei Kasahara a secret from Kumiko. My relationship with her was not that big a deal. Whether I mentioned it or not was of no consequence. Once it had flowed down a certain delicate channel, however, it had become cloaked in the opacity of secretiveness, whatever my original intention may have been. The same thing had happened with Krita Kano. I had told Kumiko that Malta Kano's younger sister had come to the house, that her name was Krita, that she dressed in early 60s style, that she took samples of our tap water. But I had remained silent on the fact that she had afterwards begun to make startling revelations to me and had vanished without a word before reaching the end. Krita Kano's story had been too far out. I could never have recreated the nuances and conveyed them to Kumiko, and so I had not tried. Or then again, Kumiko might have been less than pleased that Krita Kano had stayed here long after her business was through and made all kinds of troubling personal confessions to me. And so that became another one of my little secrets. Maybe Kumiko had the same kind of secrets and was keeping them from me. With my own fund of secrets, I was in no position to blame her if she did, of course. Between the two of us, I was surely the more secretive. She tended to say what she was thinking. She was the type of person who thought things through while speaking. I was not like that. Uneasy with these ruminations, I walked towards the bathroom. The door was wide open. I stood in the doorway and looked at Kumiko from behind. She had changed into blue pajamas and was standing in front of the mirror, drying her hair with a towel. "About a job for me," I said. "I have been thinking about it. I've asked friends to be on the lookout, and I've tried a few places myself. There are jobs out there, so I can work any time I decide to work. I can start tomorrow if I make up my mind to. It's making up my mind that's hard. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if it's okay for me to pick a job out of a hat like that." "That's why I keep telling you to do what you want," she said while looking at herself in the mirror. "You don't have to find a job right away. If you're worried about the economics of it, you don't have to be. If it makes you uneasy not to have a job, if it's a burden to you to have me the only one working while you stay at home and take care of the housework, then take some job, any job for a while. I don't care." "Of course, I'll have to find a job eventually. I know that. You know that. I can't go on hanging around like this forever, and I will find a job sooner or later. It's just that right now I don't know what kind of a job I should take. For a while after I left, I just figured I'd take some other law-related job. I do have connections in the field. But now I can't get myself into the mood. The more time that passes, the less interest I have in law. I feel more and more that it's simply not the work for me." Kumiko looked at me in the mirror. I went on. "But knowing what I don't want to do doesn't help me figure out what I do want to do. I could do just about anything if somebody made me, but I don't have an image of the one thing I really want to do. That's my problem now. I can't find the image." "So then," she said, putting her towel down and turning to face me, "if you're tired of law, don't do it anymore. Just forget about the bar exam. Don't get all worked up about finding a job. If you can't find the image, wait until it forms by itself. What's wrong with that?" I nodded. "I just wanted to make sure I had explained to you exactly how I felt." "Good," she said. I went to the kitchen and washed my glass. She came in from the bathroom and sat at the kitchen table. "Guess who called me this afternoon?" she said. "My brother." "Oh? He's thinking of running for office. In fact, he's just about decided to do it." "Running for office?" This came as such a shock to me. I could hardly speak for a moment. "You mean for the Diet?" "That's right. They're asking him to run for my uncle's seat in Niigata." "I thought it was all set for your uncle's son to succeed him. He was going to resign his directorship at Dentsu or something and go back to Niigata." She started cleaning her ears with a cotton swab. "That was the plan, but my cousin doesn't want to do it. He's got his family in Tokyo, and he enjoys his work. He's not ready to give up such an important post with the world's largest advertising firm and move back to the wilds of Niigata just to become a Diet member. The main opposition is from his wife. She doesn't want him sacrificing the family to run for office.
The elder brother of Kumiko's father had spent 4 or 5 terms in the lower house representing that electoral district in Niigata. While not exactly a heavyweight, he had a fairly impressive record, having risen at one point to a minor cabinet post. Now, however, advanced age and heart disease would make it impossible for him to stand at the next election, which meant that someone would have to take over his constituency. This uncle had 2 sons, but the elder had never intended to go into politics, and so the younger was the obvious choice.
"Now the people in the district are dying to have my brother run. They want somebody young and smart and energetic, somebody who can serve for several terms with the talent to become a major power in central government. My brother has a name. He'll attract the young vote. He's perfect. True, he can't schmooze with the locals, but the support organization is strong, and they'll take care of that. Plus, if he wants to go on living in Tokyo, that's no problem. All he has to do is show up for the election."
I had trouble picturing Noboru Wataya as a Diet member.
"What do you think of all this?" I asked. "He's got nothing to do with me. He can become a Diet member or an astronaut, for all I care."
"But why did he make a point of coming to you for advice?"
"Don't be ridiculous," she said with a dry voice. "He wasn't asking my advice. You know he'd never do that. He was just keeping me informed, as a member of the family."
"I see," I said. "Still, if he's going to run for the Diet, won't it be a problem that he's divorced and single?"
"I wonder," said Kumiko. "I don't know anything about politics or elections or anything. They just don't interest me. But anyway, I'm pretty sure he'll never get married again. To anybody. He should never have got married in the first place. That's not what he wants from life. He's after something else. Something completely different from what you or I want. I know that for sure."
"Oh, really?" Kumiko wrapped 2 used cotton swabs in a tissue and threw them in the wastebasket. Then she raised her head and looked straight at me.
"I once saw him masturbating. I opened a door, and there he was."
"So what? Everybody masturbates," I said.
"No, you don't understand," she said.
Then she sighed.
"It happened maybe 2 years after my sister died. He was probably in college, and I was about 8. My mother had wavered between getting rid of my sister's things and stowing them away, and in the end she decided to keep them, thinking I might wear them when I got older. She had put them in a box in a wardrobe. My brother had taken them out and was smelling them and doing it."
I kept silent.
"I was just a little girl then. I didn't know anything about sex. I really didn't know what he was doing, but I could tell that it was something twisted, something I wasn't supposed to see, something much deeper than it appeared on the surface."
Kumiko shook her head. "Does Noboru Wataya know you saw him?"
"Of course! We looked right into each other's eyes!"
I nodded. "And how about your sister's clothes?" I asked. "Did you wear them when you got bigger?"
"No way!" she said.
"So you think he was in love with your sister?"
"I wonder," said Kumiko. "I'm not even sure he had a sexual interest in her, but he certainly had something. And I suspect he's never been able to get away from that something. That's what I mean when I say he should never have got married in the first place."
Kumiko fell silent. For a long time, neither of us said anything. Then she spoke.
"In that sense, I think he may have some serious psychological problems. Of course, we all have psychological problems to some extent, but his are a lot worse than whatever you or I might have. They're a lot deeper and more persistent. And he has no intention of letting these scars or weaknesses or whatever they are be seen by anybody else. Ever. Do you understand what I'm saying? This election coming up, it worries me."
"Worries you? How's that?"
"I don't know, it just does," she said. "Anyhow, I'm tired. I can't think any more today. Let's go to bed."
Brushing my teeth in the bathroom, I studied my face in the mirror. For over 2 months now since leaving my job, I had rarely entered the outside world. I'd been moving back and forth between the local shops, the swimming pool, and this house. Apart from the Ginza and that hotel in Shinagawa, the farthest point I had traveled from home was the cleaners by the station. And in all that time, I had hardly seen anyone. Apart from Kumiko, the only people I could be said to have seen in 2 months were Malta and Krita Kano and Mei Kasahara. It was a narrow world, a world that was standing still. But the narrower it became, and the more it consisted of stillness, the more this world that enveloped me seemed to overflow with things and people that could only be called strange. They had been there all the while, it seemed, waiting in the shadows for me to stop moving. And every time the wind-up bird came to my yard to wind its spring, the world descended more deeply into chaos. I rinsed my mouth and went on looking at my face for a time. "I can't find the image," I said to myself. "I'm 30, I'm standing still, and I can't find the image." When I came from the bathroom to the bedroom, Kumiko was asleep. 11. Enter Lieutenant Mamiya. What came from the warm mud? Eau de Cologne. 3 days later, Tokutaro Mamiya rang. At 7:30 in the morning, I was eating breakfast with Kumiko.
"I am very, very sorry to call you so early in the morning. I do hope I haven't woken you,"
said Mr. Mamiya, sounding genuinely apologetic. I assured him that it was all right. I woke up every morning shortly after 6. He thanked me for my postcard and explained that he wanted to get me before I left for work this morning, adding that he would be most grateful if I could see him briefly today during my lunch break. He was hoping to take an evening bullet train back to Hiroshima. He had planned to have more time here, he said, but something had come up that made it necessary for him to return home as soon as possible. I pointed out that I was presently unemployed, that I was free all day, and that I could see him at his convenience, be it morning, noon, afternoon, or whatever.
"But surely you must have something planned at some point in the day?"
he inquired with the utmost politeness. "I had no plan at all," I replied.
"That being the case, might I be permitted to call upon you at your residence this morning at 10 o'clock?
"That would be fine." Only after I hung up did it occur to me that I had forgotten to tell him how to find our house from the station. Oh, well, I figured. He knows the address. He can make his way here if he wants to. "Who was that?" asked Kumiko. "The guy who's distributing Mr. Honda's keepsakes. He's going to bring mine here later this morning." "No kidding." She took a sip of coffee and spread butter on her toast. "That's very nice of him." "It is. By the way," she said, "shouldn't we, or at least you, go to pay our respects at Mr. Honda's, burn a stick of incense, that sort of thing?" "Good idea. I'll ask him about that." Preparing to leave the house, Kumiko asked me to zip her dress up. It was a tight fit and took some doing. She was wearing a lovely fragrance behind her ears, something perfect for a summer morning. "New cologne?" I asked. Instead of answering, she glanced at her watch and reached up to fix her hair. "I'm late," she said, and took her handbag from the table. I had straightened up the little room that Kumiko used for work and was emptying the wastebasket when I noticed a yellow ribbon she had thrown away. It was peeking out from under a crumpled sheet of writing paper and a few pieces of junk mail. Its bright, glossy yellow was what had caught my eye. It was the kind of ribbon used to wrap presents, the bow tied in the shape of a flower. I picked it up out of the wastebasket and examined it. The ribbon had been discarded, along with some wrapping paper, from the Matsuya department store. Under the paper was a box bearing the Christian Dior label. The lining inside the box formed the shape of a bottle. Judging from the box, this had been a pretty expensive item. I took it with me to the bathroom and opened Kumiko's cosmetics cabinet. Inside was a virtually unused bottle of Christian Dior Eau de Cologne, shaped like the hollow in the box. I opened the bottle's gold-colored cap and took a sniff. It was the same fragrance I had smelled behind Kumiko's ears. I sat on the sofa, drinking the rest of my morning coffee and collecting my thoughts. Someone had obviously given Kumiko a gift, an expensive gift. Bought it at the Matsuya department store and had it wrapped with a ribbon. If the person who did this was a man, he was someone close to Kumiko. Men didn't give women, especially married women, cologne unless their relationship was a close one. If a woman friend had given it to her. But did women give eau de cologne to other women? I could not be sure. One thing I could be sure of, though, was that there was no particular reason for Kumiko to be receiving presents from other people at this time of year. Her birthday was in May, so was our anniversary. She might conceivably have bought herself a bottle of cologne and had it wrapped with a pretty ribbon. But why? I sighed and looked at the ceiling. Should I ask her about it directly? Did somebody give you that cologne? She might answer. Oh, that. One of the girls at work had a personal problem I helped her out with. It's too long a story to go into, but she was in a jam. This was a thank you gift. Wonderful fragrance, don't you think? It's expensive stuff. Okay, that makes sense. That does it. No need to ask. No need to be concerned. Except, I was concerned. She should have said something to me about it. If she had time to go to her room, untie the ribbon, tear off the wrapping paper, open the box, throw all three in the wastebasket, and put the bottle in her cosmetics cabinet, she should have been able to come to me and say, "Look at this present I got from one of the girls at work." Instead, she had said nothing. Maybe she had thought it wasn't worth mentioning. Now, however, it had taken on the thin veil of secrecy. That was what was bothering me. I looked at the ceiling for a long time. I tried to think about something else, but my mind wouldn't cooperate. I kept thinking about Kumiko at the moment I zipped up her dress, her smooth white back, the fragrance behind her ears. For the first time in months, I wanted a smoke. I wanted to put a cigarette in my mouth, light up, and suck the smoke into my lungs. That would have calmed me down. But I didn't have any cigarettes. I found a lemon drop and sucked on that. At 10 to 10, the phone rang. I assumed it was Lieutenant Mamiya. This house was not easy to find. Even people who had been here more than once sometimes got lost. But the call was not from Lieutenant Mamiya. What I heard coming from the receiver was the voice of the enigmatic woman who had phoned me the other day.
"Hi, honey. It's been a while," she said. "How did you like it last time? Did I get you going a little bit? Why did you hang up on me? And just when things were getting interesting?"
For a split second, I thought she was talking about my recent wet dream about Greta Kahno. But that had been a different story. She was talking about the day she called me when I was cooking spaghetti. "Sorry," I said, "but I'm pretty busy right now. I'm expecting a visitor in 10 minutes, and I've got to get the place ready."
"You're awfully busy for somebody who's supposed to be out of work," she said, with a sarcastic edge.
The same thing had happened last time. Her tone of voice changed from one second to the next.
"You're cooking spaghetti? You're expecting a visitor? But that's all right. All we need is 10 minutes. Let's talk for 10 minutes, just you and me. You can hang up when your guest arrives."
I wanted to hang up without saying a word, but I couldn't do it. I was probably still upset about Kumiko's cologne. Perhaps I felt like talking to someone and it didn't much matter who. "Look," I said, "I don't have any idea who you are." I picked up the pencil lying beside the phone and twirled it in my fingers as I spoke. "Are you sure I know you?"
"Of course you do. I told you last time. I know you, and you know me. I wouldn't lie about a thing like that. I don't have time to waste calling complete strangers. You must have some kind of blind spot in your memory."
"I don't know about that. Really, though..."
"Enough,"
she said, cutting me off.
"Stop thinking so much. You know me, and I know you. The important thing is, well, look at it this way. I'm going to be very nice to you. But you don't have to do a thing. Isn't that marvelous? You don't have to do a thing. You have no responsibilities, and I do everything. Everything. Don't you think that's great? So stop thinking so much. Stop making everything so complicated. Empty yourself out. Pretend you're lying in some nice, soft mud on a warm spring afternoon.
I kept silent.
You're asleep. You're dreaming. You're lying in nice, warm mud. Forget about your wife. Forget you're out of work. Forget about the future. Forget about everything. We all emerge from the warm mud, and we all go back to it. Finally. Oh, by the way, Mr. Okada, when was the last time you had sex with your wife? Do you remember? Quite some time ago, wasn't it? Yes, indeed. Maybe 2 weeks now?
Sorry, my visitor is here, I said.
More than 2 weeks, wasn't it? I can tell from your voice. 3 weeks, maybe?
I said nothing.
Oh, well, never mind,
she said, her voice like a little broom sweeping off the dust that had piled up on the slats of a Venetian blind.
That's between you and your wife. But I will give you everything you want. And you, Mr. Okada, need have no responsibilities in return. Just go round the corner, and there it is, a world you've never seen. I told you have a blind spot, didn't I? You still don't understand.
Gripping the receiver, I maintained my silence.
Look around, she said. Look all around you, and tell me what's there. What is it you see?
Just then the doorbell rang. Relieved, I hung up without a word. Lieutenant Mamiya was a bald, old gentleman of exceptional height who wore gold-rimmed glasses. He had the tanned, healthy look of a man who has done his share of manual labor without an ounce of excess flesh. 3 deep wrinkles marked the corner of each eye with perfect symmetry, as if he were on the verge of squinting because he found the light harsh. It was difficult to tell his age, though he couldn't have been less than 70. I imagined he must have been a strapping fellow in his prime. This was obvious from his erect carriage and efficient movements. His demeanor and speech showed the utmost respectfulness, but rather than elaborate formality, gave an impression of unadorned precision. The lieutenant appeared to be a man accustomed to making his own decisions and taking responsibility for them. He wore an unremarkable light gray suit, a white shirt, and a gray and black striped tie. The no-nonsense suit appeared to be made of a material that was a bit too thick for a hot and humid June morning, but the lieutenant was unmarked by a drop of sweat. He had a prosthetic left hand, on which he wore a thin glove of the same light gray color as the suit. Encased in this gray glove, the artificial hand looked especially cold and inorganic when compared with the tanned and hairy right hand from which dangled a cloth-wrapped bundle knotted at the top. I showed him to the living room couch and served him a cup of green tea. He apologized for not having a name card.
I used to teach social studies in a rural public high school in Hiroshima Prefecture. But I haven't done anything since I retired. I grow a few vegetables, more as a hobby than anything. Just simple farm work. For that reason, I do not happen to carry a name card, although I realize it is terribly rude of me.
I didn't have a name card either.
Forgive me, but I wonder how old you might be, Mr. Okada.
I'm 30, I said. He nodded. Then he took a sip of tea. I had no idea what he made of me being 30 years old.
This is such a nice, quiet home you live in,
he said, as if to change the subject. I told him how I came to be renting it from my uncle for so little. Ordinarily, with our income, we couldn't afford to live in a house half the size, I added. Nodding, he stole a few hesitant glances around the place. I followed his lead and did the same. Look all around you. The woman's voice had ordered me. Taking this newly conscious look at my surroundings, I detected a certain coldness in the pervading atmosphere.
"I've been in Tokyo 2 weeks altogether on this trip," said Lieutenant Mamiya, "and you are the very last person to whom I am distributing a keepsake. Now I feel I can go back to Hiroshima."
"I was hoping I could visit Mr. Honda's home and perhaps burn a stick of incense in his memory," I said.
"That is a most laudable intention, but Mr. Honda's home, and now his grave, are in Asaikawa, Hokkaido. His family came from Asaikawa to sort out the things he left in his house in Meguro, and now they have gone back. There is nothing left."
"I see," I said. "So Mr. Honda was living alone in Tokyo then, far away from his family?"
"That is correct. The eldest son, who lives in Asaikawa, was concerned about leaving his old father to live by himself in the big city, and he knew that it did not look very good. Apparently, he tried to persuade his father to come and live with him, but Mr. Honda refused."
"He had a son?" I asked, somewhat taken aback. I had always thought of Mr. Honda as utterly alone in the world. "Then I assume Mr. Honda's wife must have passed away some time ago."
"Well, that is a rather complicated story. Mrs. Honda committed lover's suicide with another man after the war, in 1950 or 1951, I believe. The details of that event are not something that I would know about. Mr. Honda never said too much about it, and of course, I was in no position to ask."
I nodded.
"After that, Mr. Honda raised his children alone, one son and one daughter. When they became independent, he moved to Tokyo by himself and began his work as a diviner, which is how you knew him."
"What sort of work did he do in Asaikawa?"
"He was partners with his brother in a printing business."
I tried to imagine Mr. Honda standing in front of a printing press in overalls, checking proofs, but to me, Mr. Honda was a slightly grimy old man in a grimy old kimono with a sash more suited to a nightshirt, who sat winter and summer with his legs in the sunken hearth, playing with his divining sticks at a low table. With deft movements, Lieutenant Mamiya used his good hand to untie the cloth bundle he had brought with him. A package emerged, shaped like a small box of candy. It was wrapped in craft paper and tightly tied in several loops of string. The lieutenant placed it on the table and slid it towards me.
"This is the keepsake that Mr. Honda left with me to give to you," he said.
I picked it up. It weighed practically nothing. I couldn't begin to imagine what was inside.
"Shall I open it?" I asked.
Lieutenant Mamiya shook his head.
"I am sorry, but Mr. Honda indicated that he wished you to open it when you were alone."
I nodded and returned the package to the table.
"In fact," said Lieutenant Mamiya, "I received the letter from Mr. Honda exactly one day before he died. It said something like this: 'I am going to die very soon. I am not the least bit afraid of dying. This is the span of life that has been allotted to me by the will of heaven. Where the will of heaven is concerned, all one can do is submit to it. There is, however, something that I have left undone. In my cupboard there are various objects, things that I have wanted to pass on to certain people. Now it appears that I will not be able to accomplish that task, which is why I would be most grateful if you would help me by distributing the keepsakes on the attached list. I fully realize how presumptuous this is of me, but I do hope that you will be so kind as to think of it as my dying wish, and exert yourself this one last time for my sake.' I must say, I was utterly shocked to receive such a letter from Mr. Honda. I had been out of touch with him for years, perhaps 6 or 7 years without a word. I wrote back immediately, but my reply crossed in the post with the notice from his son that Mr. Honda had died."
He took a sip of green tea.
"Mr. Honda knew exactly when he was going to die,"
Lieutenant Mamiya continued.
He must have attained a state of mind that someone like me could never hope to reach. As you said in your postcard, there was something about him that moved people deeply. I felt that from the time I first met him, in the summer of 1938.
Oh, were you in the same unit with Mr. Honda at the time of the Nomonhan incident?
No, I wasn't,
said Lieutenant Mamiya, biting his lip.
We were in different units, different divisions even. We worked together in a small-scale military operation that preceded the Nomonhan battle. Corporal Honda was later wounded at Nomonhan and sent back to Japan. I didn't go to Nomonhan. I lost this hand of mine.
And here Lieutenant Mamiya held up his gloved left hand.
In the Soviet advance of August 1945, the month the war ended, I caught a slug in the shoulder from a heavy machine gun during a battle against a tank unit. I was on the ground, unconscious, when a Soviet tank ran over my hand. I was taken prisoner, treated in a hospital in Chita, and sent to an internment camp in Siberia. They kept me there until 1949. I was on the continent for 12 years altogether, from the time they sent me over in 1937. I never set foot on Japanese soil the whole time. My family thought I had been killed fighting the Soviets. They made a grave for me in the village cemetery. I had a kind of understanding with a girl there before I left Japan, but by the time I got back she was married to another man. 12 years is a long time.
I nodded.
I'm sorry, Mr. Okada,
he said.
This talk about the old days must be boring to a young fellow like you. I would like to add one more thing, though, and that is that we were just ordinary young men, the same as you. I never once thought I wanted to be a soldier. I wanted to be a teacher. As soon as I left college, though, they sent me my draft notice, stuck me in officer's training, and I ended up on the continent for 12 years. My life went by like a dream.
Lieutenant Mamiya clamped his mouth shut.
If you wouldn't mind, I said after some time had passed, I would very much like to hear the story of how you and Mr. Honda came to know each other. I genuinely wanted to know what kind of man Mr. Honda had been before I met him.
Hands placed precisely on his knees, Lieutenant Mamiya sat thinking about something. Not that he was uncertain as to what he should do. He was just thinking.
That story might be a long one, he said.
I don't mind, I said.
I've never told it to anyone. And I'm quite certain that Mr. Honda never told it to anyone either. The reason I say that is that we made a pact to keep this one thing secret. But Mr. Honda is dead now. I'm the only one left. It wouldn't hurt anyone if I told.
And so Lieutenant Mamiya began to tell me his story. 12. Lieutenant Mamiya's Long Story, Part 1.
I was shipped to Manchuria at the beginning of 1937,
Lieutenant Mamiya began.
I was a brand new second lieutenant then, and they assigned me to the Kwantung Army General Staff in Xingqing. Geography had been my degree in college, so I ended up in the Military Survey Corps, which specialized in map-making. This was ideal for me, because, to be quite honest, the duties I was ordered to perform were among the easiest that anyone could hope for in the Army. In addition to this, conditions in Manchuria were relatively peaceful, or at least stable. The recent China incident had moved the theater of military operations from Manchuria into China proper. The China Expeditionary Forces were the ones doing the fighting now, while the Kwantung Army had an easy time of it. True, mopping up operations were still going on against anti-Japanese guerrilla units, but they were confined to the interior, and in general the worst was over. All that the powerful Kwantung Army had to do was police our newly independent puppet state of Manchukuo while keeping an eye on the north. As peaceful as things supposedly were, it was still war, after all, so there were constant maneuvers. I didn't have to participate in those either, fortunately. They took place under terrible conditions. The temperature would drop to 40 or 50 degrees below zero. One false step in maneuvers like that and you could end up dead. Every single time they held such maneuvers, there would be hundreds of men in the hospital with frostbite, or sent to a hot spring for treatment. Xinqing was no big city, but it was certainly an exotic foreign place. And if you wanted to have fun there, it provided plenty of opportunities. New, single officers like me lived together in a kind of rooming house rather than in barracks. It was more like an extension of student life. I took it easy, thinking that I would have nothing to complain about if my military service ended like this, just one peaceful day after another. It was, of course, a make-believe peace. Just beyond the edges of our little circle of sunshine, a ferocious war was going on. Most Japanese realized that the war with China would turn into a muddy swamp from which we could never extricate ourselves. Or at least any Japanese with a brain in his head realized this. It didn't matter how many battles we won, there was no way Japan could continue to occupy and rule over such a huge country. It was obvious if you thought about it, and sure enough, as the fighting continued, the number of dead and wounded began to multiply. Relations with America went from bad to worse. Even at home, the shadows of war grew darker with every passing day. Those were dark years, 1937, 1938, but living the easy life of an officer in Xinqing, you almost wanted to ask, war, what war? We'd go out drinking and carousing every night, and we'd visit the cafes where the white Russian girls were. Then, one day, late in April 1938, a senior officer of the general staff called me in and introduced me to a fellow in mufti named Yamamoto. He wore his hair short and had a mustache. He was not a very tall man. I'd say he was in his mid-30s. He had a scar on the back of his neck that looked as if it might have been made by a blade of some kind. The officer said to me, "Mr. Yamamoto is a civilian. He's been hired by the army to investigate the life and customs of the Mongolians who live in Manchukuo. He will next be going to the Hulunbuir steppe near the Outer Mongolian border, and we are going to supply him with an armed escort. You will be a member of that detachment." I didn't believe a thing he was telling me. This Yamamoto fellow might have been wearing civilian clothes, but anybody could tell at a glance that he was a professional soldier. The look in his eyes, the way he spoke, his posture, it was obvious. I figured he was a high-ranking officer, or had something to do with intelligence, and was on a mission that required him to conceal his military identity. There was something ominous about the whole thing. Three of us were assigned to accompany Yamamoto, too few for an effective armed escort, though a larger group would have attracted the attention of the Outer Mongolian troops deployed along the border. One might have chosen to view this as a case of entrusting a sensitive mission to a few hand-picked men, but the truth was far from that. I was the only officer, and I had zero battlefield experience. The only one we could count on for fighting power was a sergeant by the name of Hamano. I knew him well as a soldier who had been assigned to assist the general staff. He was a tough fellow who had worked his way up through the ranks to become a non-commissioned officer, and he had distinguished himself in battle in China. He was big and fearless, and I was sure we could count on him in a pinch. Why they had also included Corporal Honda in our party, I had no idea. Like me, he had just arrived from home, and of course he had no battle experience. He was a gentle, quiet soul, who looked as if he would be no help at all in a fight. What's more, he belonged to the 7th Division, which meant that the General Staff had gone out of their way to have him sent over to us specifically for this assignment. That's how valuable a soldier he was. Though not until much later did the reason for this become clear. I was chosen to be the commanding officer of the escort because my primary responsibility was the topography of the western border of Manchukuo in the area of the Kalkar River. My job was to make sure that our maps of the district were as complete as possible. I'd even been over the area several times in a plane. My presence was meant to help the mission go smoothly. My second assignment was to gather more detailed topographical information on the district and so increase the accuracy of our maps. Two birds with one stone, as it were. To be quite honest, the maps we had in those days of the Hulunbuir steppe border region with Outer Mongolia were crude things, hardly an improvement over the old Manchu dynasty maps. The Kwantung army had undertaken several surveys following the establishment of Manchukuo. They wanted to make more accurate maps, but the area they had to cover was huge, and western Manchuria is just an endless desert. National borders don't mean very much in such a vast wilderness. The Mongolian nomads had lived there for thousands of years without the need, or even the concept, of borders. The political situation had also delayed the making of more accurate maps, which is to say that if we had gone ahead and unilaterally made an official map showing our idea of the border, it could have caused a full-scale international incident. Both the Soviet Union and Outer Mongolia, which shared borders with Manchukuo, were extremely sensitive about border violations, and there had been several instances of bloody combat over such matters. In our day, the army was in no mood for war with the Soviet Union. All our force was invested in the war with China, with none to spare for a large-scale clash with the Soviets. We didn't have the divisions, or the tanks, or the artillery, or the planes. The first priority was to secure the stability of Manchukuo, which is still a relatively new political entity. Establishment of the northern and northwestern borders could wait, as far as the army was concerned. They wanted to stall for time by keeping things indefinite. Even the mighty Kwantung army deferred to this view and adopted a wait-and-see attitude. As a result, everything had been allowed to drift in a sea of vagueness. If, however, their best-laid plans notwithstanding, some unforeseen event should lead to war, which is exactly what did happen the following year at Nomonhan, we would need maps to fight. Not just ordinary civilian maps, but real combat maps. To fight a war, you need maps that show you where to establish encampments, the most effective place to set up your artillery, how many days it will take your infantry to march there, where to secure water, how much feed you need for your horses, a great deal of detailed information. You just couldn't fight a modern war without such maps. Which is why much of our work overlapped with the work of the Intelligence Division, and we were constantly exchanging information with the Kwantung Army's intelligence section or the military secret service in Haila. Everyone knew everyone else, but this Yamamoto fellow was someone I had never seen before. After 5 days of preparation, we left Xinqing for Haila by train. We took a truck from there, drove it through the area of the Kandor Byo Lamaist Temple, and arrived at the Manchukuo Army's border observation post near the Kalkar River. I don't remember the exact distance, but it was something like 200 miles. The region was an empty wilderness, with literally nothing as far as the eye could see. My work required me to keep checking my map against the actual landforms, but there was nothing out there for me to check against, nothing that one could call a landmark. All I could see were shaggy, grass-covered mounds stretching on, the unbroken horizon, and clouds floating in the sky. There was no way I could have any precise idea where on the map we were. All I could do was guess according to the amount of time we had been driving. Sometimes, when one is moving silently through such an utterly desolate landscape, an overwhelming hallucination can cause one to feel that oneself, as an individual human being, is slowly unraveling. The surrounding space is so vast that it becomes more and more difficult to keep a balanced grip on one's own being. I wonder if I'm making myself clear. The mind expands to fill the entire landscape, becoming so diffuse in the process that one loses the ability to keep it fastened to the physical self. That is what I experienced in the midst of the Mongolian steppe. How vast it was! It felt more like an ocean than a desert landscape. The sun would rise from the eastern horizon, cut its way across the empty sky, and sink below the western horizon. This was the only perceptible change in our surroundings, and in the movement of the sun I felt something I hardly know how to name. Some huge cosmic love. At the border post of the Manchukuo army, we transferred from truck to horseback. They had everything ready for us, 4 horses to ride, plus 2 pack horses loaded with food, water, and weapons. We were lightly armed. I and the man called Yamamoto carried only pistols. Hamano and Honda carried Model 38 regulation infantry rifles and 2 hand grenades each, in addition to their pistols. The de facto commander of our group was Yamamoto. He made all the decisions and gave us instructions. Since he was supposedly a civilian, military rules required that I act as commanding officer, but no one doubted that he was the one in charge. He was simply that kind of man, for one thing, and although I held the rank of second lieutenant, I was nothing but a pencil pusher without battle experience. Military men can see who holds actual power, and that is the one they obey. Besides, my superiors had ordered me to follow Yamamoto's instructions without question. My obedience to him was to be something that transcended the usual laws and regulations. We proceeded to the Kalka River and followed it to the south. The river was swollen with thawed snow. We could see large fish in the water. Sometimes in the distance we spotted wolves. They might have been part wild dog rather than purebred wolves, but in any case they were dangerous. We had to post a sentry each night to guard the horses from them. We also saw a lot of birds, most of them migratory fowl on their way back to Siberia. Yamamoto and I discussed features of the topography. Checking our route against the map, we kept detailed notes on every bit of information that came to our notice. Aside from these technical exchanges, however, Yamamoto hardly ever spoke to me. He spurred his horse on in silence, ate separately from the rest of us, and went to sleep without a word. I had the impression that this was not his first trip to the area. He had amazingly precise knowledge of the landforms, directions, and so forth. After we had proceeded southward for 2 days without incident, Yamamoto called me aside and told me that we would be fording the Kalka before dawn the next morning. This came as a tremendous shock to me. The opposite shore was outer Mongolian territory. Even the bank on which we stood was a dangerous area of border disputes.
The Outer Mongolians laid claim to it, and Manchu Kuo asserted its own claims to the territory, which had led to continual armed clashes. If we were ever taken prisoner by Outer Mongolian troops on this side, the differing views of the two countries gave us some excuse for being there, though in fact there was little danger of encountering them in this season, when melting snow made fording so difficult. The far bank was a different story altogether. Mongolian patrols were there for certain. If we were captured there, we would have no excuse whatever. It would be a clear case of border violation, which could stir up all kinds of political problems. We could be shot on the spot, and our government would be unable to protest. In addition, my superior officer had given me no indication that it would be all right for us to cross the border. I had, of course, been told to follow Yamamoto's orders, but I had no way of knowing if this included such a grave offense as a border violation. Secondly, as I said earlier, the Kalka was quite swollen, and the current was far too strong to make a crossing, in addition to which the water was freezing cold. Not even the nomadic tribes liked to ford the river at this time of year. They usually restricted their crossings to winter, when the river was frozen, or summer, when the flow was down and the water temperature up. When I said all this to him, Yamamoto stared at me for a moment. Then he nodded several times. "I understand your concern about the violation of international borders," he said to me, with a somewhat patronizing air. "It is entirely natural for you as an officer with men under your command to consider the question of responsibility in such a matter. You would never want to put the lives of your men in danger without good cause, but I want you to leave such questions to me. I will assume all responsibility in this instance. I am not in a position to explain a great deal to you, but this matter has been cleared with the highest levels of the army. As regards the fording of the river, we have no technical obstacles. There is a hidden point at which it is possible to cross. The Outer Mongolian army has constructed and secured several such points. I suspect that you are fully aware of this as well. I myself have crossed the river a number of times at this point. I entered Outer Mongolia last year at this time, at this same place. There is nothing for you to worry about." He was right about one thing. The Outer Mongolian army, which knew this area in detail, had sent combat units, though just a few of them, to this side of the river during the season of melting snow. They had made sure they could send whole units across at will, and if they could cross, then this man called Yamamoto could cross, and it would not be impossible for the rest of us to cross, too. We stood now at one of those secret fords that had been built by the Outer Mongolian army. Camouflaged with care, it would not have been obvious to the casual observer. A plank bridge, secured against the swift current by ropes, connected the shallows on either side beneath the surface of the water. A slight drop in the water level would make for an easy crossing by troop transport vehicles, armored cars, and such. Reconnaissance planes could never spot it underwater. We made our way across the river's strong flow by clinging to the ropes. Yamamoto went first, to be certain there were no Outer Mongolian patrols in the area, and we followed. Our feet went numb in the cold water, but we and our horses struggled across to the far shore of the Kalka River. The land rose much higher on the far side, and standing there we could see for miles across the desert expanse from which we had come. This was one reason the Soviet army would always be in the more advantageous position when the battle for Nomonhan eventually broke out. The difference in elevation would also make for a huge difference in the accuracy of artillery fire. In any case,
I remember being struck by how different the view was on either side of the river. I remember, too, how long it took to regain feeling in limbs that had been soaked in the icy water. I couldn't even get my voice to work for a while. But to be quite honest, the sheer tension that came from knowing I was in enemy territory was enough to make me forget about the cold. We followed the river southward. Like an undulating snake, the Kalka flowed on below us to the left. Shortly after the crossing, Yamamoto advised us to remove all insignia of rank, and we did as we were told. Such things could only cause trouble if we were captured by the enemy, I assumed. For this reason, I also removed my officer's boots and changed into gaiters. We were setting up camp that evening when a man approached us from the distance, riding alone. He was a Mongol. The Mongols use an unusually high saddle, which makes it easier to distinguish them from afar. Sergeant Hamano snapped up his rifle when he saw the figure approaching, but Yamamoto told him not to shoot. Hamano slowly lowered his rifle without a word. The four of us stood there, waiting for the man to draw closer. He had a Soviet-made rifle strapped to his back and a Mauser at his waist. Whiskers covered his face, and he wore a hat with ear flaps. His filthy robes were the same kind as the nomads, but you could tell from the way he handled himself that he was a professional soldier. Dismounting, the man spoke to Yamamoto in what I assumed was Mongolian. I had some knowledge of both Russian and Chinese, and what he spoke was neither of those, so it must have been Mongolian. Yamamoto answered in the man's own language. This made me surer than ever that Yamamoto was an intelligence officer. Yamamoto said to me, "Lieutenant Mamiya, I will be leaving with this man. I don't know how long I will be away, but I want you to wait here, posting a sentry at all times, of course. If I'm not back in 36 hours, you are to report that fact to headquarters. Send one man back across the river to the Manchukuo Army Observation Post." He mounted his horse and rode off with the Mongol, heading west. The three of us finished setting up camp and ate a simple dinner. We couldn't cook or build a campfire. On that vast steppe, with nothing but low sand dunes as far as the eye could see to shield our presence, the least puff of smoke would have led to our immediate capture. We pitched our tents low in the shelter of the dunes, and for supper we ate dry crackers and cold canned meat. Darkness swiftly covered us when the sun sank beneath the horizon, and the sky was filled with an incredible number of stars. Mixed in with the roar of the Kalka River, the sound of wolves howling came to us as we lay on the sand, recovering from the day's exertions. Sergeant Hamano said to me, "Looks like a tough spot we've got ourselves in," and I had to agree with him. By then, the three of us, Sergeant Hamano, Corporal Honda, and I, had got to know each other pretty well. Ordinarily, a fresh young officer like me would be kept at arm's length and laughed at by a seasoned non-commissioned officer like Sergeant Hamano, but our case was different. He respected the education I had received in a non-military college, and I took care to acknowledge his combat experience and practical judgment without letting rank get in the way. We also found it easy to talk to each other because he was from Yamaguchi, and I was from an area of Hiroshima close to Yamaguchi. He told me about the war in China. He was every bit a soldier, with only grammar school behind him, but he had his own reservations about this messy war on the continent, which looked as if it would never end, and he expressed these feelings honestly to me. "I don't mind fighting," he said. "I'm a soldier, and I don't mind dying in battle for my country, because that's my job. But this war we're fighting now, Lieutenant, well, it's just not right. It's not a real war, with a battle line where you face the enemy and fight to the end. We advance, and the enemy runs away without fighting.
Then the Chinese soldiers take their uniforms off and mix with the civilian population, and we don't even know who the enemy is. So then we kill a lot of innocent people in the name of flushing out renegades or remnant troops, and we commandeer provisions. We have to steal their food because the line moves forward so fast our supplies can't catch up with us, and we have to kill our prisoners because we don't have anywhere to keep them or any food to feed them. It's wrong, Lieutenant. We did some terrible things in Nanking. My own unit did. We threw dozens of people into a well and dropped hand grenades in after them. Some of the things we did I can't bring myself to